As we gather again, we have Dr. Binu Mukherjee, who has a theme which I find fascinating. Science and need of evolutionary change. The operative word is need. Science needs it, not consciousness. I mean, so to speak. Why? Where? At what point? Now, Binu just says that this is the kind of in-depth exploration would have been nice to do in a little roundtable kind of gathering. So we'll take him on his word at that, and this is only the preliminary, and we'll have that later with him.
Thank you. Thank you. Many of you who have been coming to these meetings regularly for the last couple of years, of course, have heard me, so that a part of this talk might be somewhat repetitive. My intention today is to divide this talk into two parts. The first will directly address the title of the talk, which is Science and the Need for Evolutionary Change. And this would appear to suggest that science is a failure, which in some ways it is. And at the same time, there has, of course, been tremendous success in a material sense. But I will also show the need for science in a yogic sense in the second part of my talk. From a human standpoint, of course, the scientific age, the industrial age, has been a remarkably successful one, leading as it has to the release of energy from the atom, for example, the sending of humans to the moon and space more generally, to the transistors we use. In fact, in every way, technology has led to a fairly luxurious form of living, and we have enjoyed that very much. Not only has the pursuit of science led to a remarkable development of the human mind, and this is the other side of the coin to which I will come back later, but the approach of science has come to be widely accepted as the ideal way of cognition that distinguishes man from lesser developed creatures. Today, I propose to analyze this scientific approach, the foundation of science, if you like, and to discuss a few examples of how this approach fails to achieve self-consistency and therefore requires us to consider realms of higher knowledge. The presentation of the first part is really based on a talk which was given to me, which I heard in 1958 from Dr. M. Venkatraman. Some of you may remember him. He's a great devotee of Sri Aurobindo and the Mother, a world-famous professor of pure mathematics. He was head of department at the universities of Madurai and Hyderabad in succession. And he came here and taught us from time to time. I am a product, by the way, of the Sri Aurobindo International Center of Education. The scientific process is largely based on the ideas of mathematical logic. This logical process consists in making a series of affirmations, each of which is supposed to be, if you like, a, within quotes, a valid logical affirmation, a consequence of affirmations made earlier. These reflect an unanalyzable intuition in man of a logical deduction being correct or not, an intuition that is inbuilt in all human beings. This explains why humanity all over the world accepts mathematical scientific deduction as being a sort of ideal process for expressing truth. This logical intuition can, of course, be codified and expressed as a collection of rules. Just to take an example, we can say, for example, when a proposition is asserted, it can be reasserted. Simple enough. If propositions A and B are true, then A and B are true as well as A or B are true. And one can go on. I'm not going to go into the details of this. So it is possible, in fact, to codify what we understand as logic. The intuitions of logic on which these propositions are clearly common to are clearly common to all human beings, to all rational human beings, and have been given to us a priori. These then seem to be the key that will explain the behavior of all things in the universe and lead to God's truth. science was considered well established as long as it was amenable to mathematical formulation and treatment, and any activity was respected if it was scientific. And thus it was that scientists, after great labor, were able to proceed from success to success. Occasional stumbling blocks arose, but rather than seek another intuition, scientists turned back to check that all was coordinated by the mathematical and deductive logical process. And so the world seemed to progress, even though it was clear that the moral texture of man had not kept pace with the rate of mental development, and this led to much unhappiness and disasters. But let us see if the scientific method itself is as perfect as it appears to be. Let us look back at one of the first signal successes of mathematical activity, geometry. And I chose this in a way because I think most of us in school have had some contact with geometry. This had been worked out as an almost perfect discipline by Euclid in the 3rd century before Christ. He had a series of postulates on which the whole of Euclidean geometry is based. And the last of these postulates, some of you might remember it from your school days, was that it was always possible to have two parallel straight lines. If you had one line and any point given, you could always draw a parallel line passing through that point. Well, Euclid himself, to some extent, had some doubts about this postulate. He did not. He placed it last amongst his postulates, and he used it in deducing other results almost as late as possible. But mathematicians tried to prove this axiom as a logical consequence of the earlier ones, but failed, right up to the 18th century. Gauss, often considered the prince among mathematicians, worked out that this postulate need not be true. And soon after, he actually didn't publish this because for 18 centuries, Euclid's geometries had stood, and he was very chary about upsetting the whole scheme of things. But soon after that, Bolyai in Hungary and Lobachevsky in Russia worked out a non-Euclidean geometry in which the parallel postulate was not true. Initially, this was not considered to be very important. People thought, well, this is not, the real world doesn't really need this very much. But later, Poincaré and Klein showed that a non-Euclidean geometry could be built up completely from portions of Euclidean geometry itself. So now this was very bad. Self-consistency was missing. And logic can be nothing if it is not self-consistent. Things became worse when Einstein and Minkowski were able to show that the universe itself was non-Euclidean. The real universe does not have parallel lines. Now, the importance of the foregoing description of the developments in geometry lies in the fact that they made mathematicians sit up and take notice. They began to ponder on the meaning of saying that a system was logically consistent or free from logical contradictions. How could they be sure that mathematics would not lead to self-contradictions? They found that if this were not so, there would be an inconsistency arising from the postulates that specify the number system. Now, obviously, there's a great deal of mathematics in what I'm saying. I'm only giving you an outline, and that's all that we can discuss in this audience. And secondly, I'm not myself a mathematician. So they found then that if there was such an inconsistency, then the number system is the one that we must really investigate. What's the meaning, for example, of 2 plus 2 is 4? If the number system were God-given and could be proved to be free from contradictions, then all rest would be fine. Unfortunately for the purveyors of logic, Gödel proved that it was impossible to show that the number system is self-consistent. Since then, there have been other paradoxes that have been found in the logical structure of mathematics that have not been solved to universal satisfaction. So our entire world of logic breaks down. Another difficulty arises in science, and I'm now moving from I've shown you, in a sense, that mathematics itself based on logic is not self-consistent. Let's see other examples, and I'm going to turn to physics now for one of my examples. Another difficulty arises in science from our supposition that logic should be universal and therefore objective. We are all aware of matter and that matter is made up of particles. We are also aware that energy can travel through empty space, as light does, for example, as radio waves do when you listen on the shortwave, for example, on the radio. So we are aware that energy can travel through empty space, for example, in the transmission of light or magnetic effects by means of waves. In the early part of the last century, it was found, a little over 100 years ago, that no clear distinction could be made between matter and waves. Particles showed wave-like properties, and waves behaved as if they were particles. This seeming contradiction could only be solved by the advent of quantum mechanics. Now, quantum mechanics is a very mathematical theory. It is not susceptible to an intuitive presentation. But although quantum mechanics has been able to explain most observed phenomena, it gives rise to a curious difficulty, for it predicts, for example, that if we were to accurately measure or know the position of a particle, it would make it impossible for us to know its speed. Because in attempting to find the position, we influence the speed. We influence its properties in our attempt to observe what is happening. That is to say, as I just said, that in measuring its position, we would have affected its speed and therefore imposed ourselves on what we are trying to observe. This is a quite remarkable conclusion. We can therefore say in a very objective fashion that our observation is subjective, with a somewhat altered sense of the word subjective, if you will. Any detailed analysis of this will have to be left to another day, but this result has led to speculation about whether the observer's consciousness affects the results of an observation, thus upsetting completely the objectivity on which all of science was originally founded. Let me then quote Dr. Venkatraman. He says, "We have followed the highest light that is vouchsafed to science, and we see that it leads to a wilderness, or to the realization that the lights on which it is founded are not completely self-luminous." The best scientific minds have not been able to show that the inadequacies that we have discussed can be solved by going deeper into the scheme of science. And this leads us to wonder whether the logical and deductive basis of our search for truth should not be replaced by higher intuitions that we might be able to access. Sri Aurobindo and the mother, following earlier mystics, have made it clear that such higher realms of knowledge exist and can be brought into play. Parallel with the development and success of science has been the development of the human mind. And I will come to this in a minute. But following what I have just said, I'd like to come here to a quotation from Sri Aurobindo. "Intellect, if it goes sincerely to its own end, has to return and give this report. I cannot know. There is, or at least it seems to me, that there may be, or even must be, something beyond, some ultimate reality. But about its truth, I can only speculate. It is either unknowable or cannot be known by me. Or if it, in other words, or if the intellect has received some light on the way from what is beyond it, it can say too, there is perhaps a consciousness beyond mind. For I seem to catch glimpses of it and even to get intimations from it. If that is in touch with the beyond, or if it is itself the consciousness of the beyond, and you can find some way to reach it, then this something can be known, but not otherwise." I don't really have time today to discuss the evidence of the developed mind catching glimpses of the beyond as mentioned by Sri Aurobindo. But such evidence also exists. A lot of top scientists have talked about the fact that their ideas come from somewhere above the mind. But I shall just conclude by saying that the developed intellect, I think, is now close to the point of realizing what Sri Aurobindo has suggested it should. Now, what I've said so far may give the impression that science is a failure. Well, of course, we know in practical terms that that is very far from the case. The tremendous achievements of the scientific revolution in practical terms is something that we see all around us at this time. But the real, I think, the most important achievement of the scientific age is not in the things that we see around us. It is in the fact that it enabled the development of the human mind. And that is a very precious development. For the mind to develop, it has really to work at the limits of its possibilities. And when one practices science, I'm not talking here about the results of science, but when one practices science, one is pushing the mind to its limits. If you want to develop a muscle and you take a light piece of paper and do that, it doesn't develop your muscle. You can sit in a coffee shop and talk intellectuality with other friends for ages. It's not going to develop your muscle. It's not going to develop your mind. It's when you push the mind to its limits, just as if you exercise with weights that are close to the maximum you can lift, that develops the muscles. The same thing is true with the mind. And research in science has helped considerably in developing the human mind. And when and not only in developing the human mind, but as we have come to the limit, as we have seen from what I've just said, the human mind begins to realize its limitations. No instrument is useful until you know the limitations of it. Even a simple screwdriver cannot be properly used if you do not know the limitations of the screwdriver. Similarly with the mind. It's only when we know its limitations that it can be used to its full. And the mind is now coming to the point where it realizes its own limitations. It knows where it cannot go. And it then becomes a willing partner in quieting itself when you really wish to go beyond the mind. So that is a very important, I believe, contribution, not necessarily only from the pursuit of science, but certainly the pursuit of science has helped considerably in developing the human mind. That, I believe, is the biggest success, if anything, of the scientific age. And that is very important from the spiritual perspective, because in order to go beyond the mind, while the mind has its uses, we need to silence the mind. But in saying that, let us not forget that the mind itself has a lot of use. By the way, I'm not going to, Mother has spoken at many instances about the usefulness of science in developing oneself spiritually. But since I've just spoken about the mind, I would like to finish with a quotation from Sri Aurobindo about the importance of the mind. He writes, "The visible imperfections and limitations of mind in the present stage of its evolution here, we take as part of its very nature. But in fact, the boundaries in which it is still penned are only temporary limits and measures of its still incomplete evolutionary advance. Its defects of methods and means are faults of its immaturity and not proper to the constitution of its being. Its achievement, although extraordinary under the hampering conditions of the mental being weighed down by its instrumentation in an earthly body, is far below and not beyond what will be possible to it in its illumined future. For mind is not, in its very nature, an inventor of errors, a father of lies bound down to a capacity of falsehood, wedded to its own mistakes, and the leader of a stumbling life, as it too largely is at present, owing to our human shortcomings. In its origin, it is a principle of light, an instrument put forth from the supermind, and though set to work within limits and even set to create limits, yet the limits are luminous borders for a special working, voluntary and purposive bounds, a service of the finite ever extending itself under the eye of infinity. It is this character of mind that will reveal itself under the touch of supermind, and make human mentality an adjunct and minor instrumentation of the supramental knowledge. It will even be possible for the luminous reproduction of the truth, it will even be possible for the mind, no longer limited by the intellect, to become capable of a sort of mental gnosis, a luminous reproduction of the truth in a diminished working, extending the power of the light not only to its own, but to lower levels of consciousness in their climb towards self-transcendence. Overmind, intuition, illumined mind, and what I have called the higher mind. These and other levels of a spiritualized and liberated mentality will be able to reflect in the uplifted human mind and its purified and exalted feeling and force of life and action, something of their powers, and prepare the ascent of the soul to their own plateaus and peaks of an ascending existence. This is essentially the change which can be contemplated as a result of the new evolutionary order, and it would mean a considerable extension of the evolutionary field itself, and will answer the question as to the result on humanity of the advent of supermind into the earth nature. So really what I've tried to point out here is that science, first of all, fails by its own standards. And since we have no better intuition than that of logic to pursue science, it breaks down. And there we see the need, from that point of view, of going higher. Secondly, we see that science, while it contributes to the development of the mind, only makes the mind more conscious, more knowledgeable about its own limitations, and again points the need for higher realms of knowledge and better methods of understanding the truth, of getting and understanding the truth. Thank you very much.
Binu, you have drawn us from the plane of life to the achievements of mind, the frontiers at which it stands possibly today, and beyond which it is peeping into others. And this quotation from Shobindu that you put, have just read out, brings it more to the point. So we are following very interestingly a whole line of growth and mutation into the further, leaving nothing by the roadside, leaving nothing to chance, and nothing is superfluous. And perhaps if I may add one sentence before inviting Chris, who follows very logically, if I may say so, after your presentation, that the fact that the present moment is one where, on the one hand, we have the greatest of the mind's achievements, but also live through the greatest of his limitations in the mind dealing with life. That shows we are at the cusp or at the borderline, if not already across the threshold, where the mutation not only has to take place, but is taking place, because we are in a strange kind of a zone. Thank you very much, Binu. Chris, you better come near your volumes.